Good morning, everybody. Sorry I'm late this morning. It was like a Monday today. I couldn't get going. So, I appreciate everybody being here. The meeting is called to order. It's May 26, 2010 at about 9:15. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of this meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I'd like to make a few comments. You see the picture of Wes Luttrell on the various screens. I'm going to read a few things because I don't want to miss anything. And, you know, when you have people like, you lose people like Wes, you know, it certainly has an effect. It has an effect on this organization, has an effect on the people that work with him on a daily basis, which I did not. I met Wes, but did not know him well. But, and then, of course, his family and neighbors and everything else. So I'd like to read a couple of things that Carter and I have written. And I'd ask us all to just think about Wes and his family for a couple of moments here. He was killed, of course, in a tragic accident over at the Gus Engeling Wildlife Management Area on Friday. The service for him was yesterday. He was only 32 years old when he died, but he'd already made a pronounced difference as a biologist and was well regarded for his strong commitment to stewardship and habitat management. He started with TPW as an intern, like a lot of people at TPW do. And so, you know, everybody gets to know each other. He went through Stephen F. Austin, did well there, of course, and became a wildlife biologist near his home in Sherman. And over the last 3 years, been working as a biologist at Gus Engeling. And one of his projects that intrigued me and interested me, and I know interested a lot of people, not just in that area, but people were starting to hear about it, was the development of a small acreage habitat research and demonstration area. Unfortunately, this is the area he was killed. It was a 30-acre block that Wes used to demonstrate to small acreage landowners, okay, how they could implement habitat enhancement projects such as native grass restoration, prescribed fire, control of exotic species, disking, and other practices on their land to improve wildlife. And the project was garnering a lot of accolades. And this is, again, how, you know, as we try to, we being Texas Parks and Wildlife in this department, try to help all landowners be conservation-minded and help them in trying to accomplish whatever goals they want to, but things like habitat enhancement and all the things that go with it can be done on small plots or large plots. And he was really focused on that. And it really... people are starting to know what he was doing, I'm hoping and will be encouraging that we keep that work going. To his wife Lynn, his parents and brother, particularly his fellow employees at Gus Engeling, WMA, and in the Wildlife Division, I offer the Commission's wholehearted condolences and sympathies for this tragic loss of a fine man who unquestionably exemplified the best in TPW. I'd also like to thank Commissioner Duggins for traveling over to WMA on Saturday to express the Commission's support and sympathies to the local staff. And I'd like to thank Jeff Gummels, who was Wes's supervisor and also a very close friend. Jeff has been the department's point man in dealing with this whole situation. I know it's been a very difficult time for everybody, and of course, particularly Wes's family. So at this time, I'd like to ask for a moment of silence to honor Wes's life and memory. Thank you all, and I appreciate you giving us a few minutes to honor a good man, Wes. Thank you. With that, we'll move on to business that we do have at hand, and we'll start with regulations with Chairman Friedman. Chairman Friedman.
Thank you. First order of business is approval of previous committee meeting minutes. Do I have a motion for approval? Commissioner Hughes, second Commissioner Martin, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item one, update on parks and wildlife progress and implementing the TPWD Land Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. Just a couple of things I'd like to go through with y'all this morning. First, I'm very proud to announce that Gary Salt is our new division director for Inland Fisheries. He rose to the top through a very, very competitive process that Ross led, and you all know Gary, been a longstanding biologist with this department. He's been our deputy director, and we're really proud of him and the leadership that he brings, as well as that of his team that already exists, and I know they're going to work together to do great things. And so, Gary, congratulations. Proud moment for us to have you in that leadership role. Couple of things I want to share with you. We do have one action item from the Land and Water Plan that I want to report to y'all on. One of the specific action items was that we would review our rules, all of our rules, every 4 years to make sure they're still germane and appropriate and relevant, and they're updated with the most current information. Ian Bright, as you know, has been kind of leading that effort. We actually just recently went through the update of the shrimp and oyster rules, really going back to a 2008-2009 cycle. Y'all approved those changes. She has put together a schedule of all of our rules over a four-year period. We'll start those again in 2012 and 2013, but I just wanted to catch you up on that. Ann's got the schedule for what part of our rules will be reviewed every 4 years. If you want to have more detail on that, just let her know. Also, just a quick update. Y'all had authorized us to formally enter the Interstate Wildlife Violator Compact. I'm proud to say we're now the 34th member in that compact, and that will take effect formally on the 1st of June. And we learned last night that I think Oklahoma's governor has just approved their entry, so they'll be the 35th state. So we're seeing really more and more, and I suspect ultimately most all the states will be a member of that compact. So I think that's very, very positive, and I just want to let you know that that was moving forward. The last thing I want to do, Mr. Chairman, if I could, is just a very short update on the Deepwater Horizon oil spill and specific preparedness actions that the agency is taking, and then some options that may be available to the commission. I've got a very short presentation. I'm just going to move over here to walk you through it. I am not going to spend much time this morning at all sort of going through the background and details y'all have all read extensively about what has transpired in the Gulf. Obviously, our colleagues in the Gulf states are deeply, deeply concerned about this and what it may mean to the health of the Gulf of Mexico, bays and estuaries, marshes impacted, et cetera. What I want to kind of brief y'all on is where we are on the Texas side with respect to our level of preparedness and what options may be available to the commission should any decisions need to be made about affecting our fisheries resources. Just as a quick reminder, the nearest oil to Texas is about 180 miles away from us, and so we're very fortunate in that regard. Whatever oil that we expect to get out of this is likely to come in the form of weathered tar balls that will float our way. So we likely will see impacts from that at some time on our beaches, and how much of that ends up on the sort of Sabine River, the upper part of the coast versus the lower coast. A lot of that will depend upon the loop currents and how it gets into that. Kind of two measures of readiness that we have underway. I think, as all of you know, we do operate under the State Operations Center when the governor declares an emergency, and that his Department of Emergency Management under DPS activates that. As an aside, last week we lost another great state leader and friend of this agency, Jack Colley, who was the chief of emergency management, who just was extraordinary in Hurricane Ike and other tragedies that hit the state, and he died of a heart attack, and all of us are mourning his loss and passing. Major Willie Gonzalez from our law enforcement team is our liaison to the State Operations Center. That has not been activated yet, but we have supplied them with information on all of our physical and people assets should it be activated.
We also have an interdivisional team that's been established that Mike Ray is leading that has representatives from all of the relevant divisions to make sure that there's appropriate communication and coordination. Don Pitts, who is one of our environmental specialists and biologists, is kind of the lead on communicating with other agencies and making sure that there's good communication inside the department. And Don is with us today. If there are any more specific questions that you want to ask about. Some of you had asked about the extent of coordination with other state and federal agencies. And just assure you that is going on. It's very active. Don, in particular, every day is talking to General Land Office, TCEQ, Mike Ray, Robin Rikers, working with all the fisheries chiefs and NOAA. There's a regularly scheduled call that they have to discuss matters impacting fisheries throughout the Gulf. The Department of Agriculture has also recently organized a coordination call with commercial fishing interests, and Mike's our representative on that call. But basically just want to assure you all of the relevant agencies from Coast Guard, et cetera, we're working with on a daily basis. This is a shot that shows the most recent federal closure area. It encompasses between 50 and 54,000 square miles, roughly 20 to 25% of the Gulf waters that NOAA has closed to recreational and commercial fishing. And so I wanted to make sure y'all had a chance to see that map.
Just so, be there on that. I mean, let me say to ask the question the right way. Because if you read sometimes just the general stuff that's every day or watch it on TV or whatever, maybe I called you a few days ago and made it sound like the whole Gulf was closed. I mean, how are we getting out to our constituency, particularly with Memorial Day coming and those kind of things? That, luckily, the Texas coast is not closed. Our federal waters around,
Yep, we've got an update on our website.
I'm getting ahead of you, okay,
Chairman. It's a very, very good question, and so we've got a specific link on the homepage that folks can go to for updates on the oil spill and the extent of closures. I think, thankfully, the media is doing a better job of not going down to the path of the entire Gulf issue, mm-hmm. shut down, and reporting on that a little more accurately. Through coastal fisheries, certainly serving as an important liaison to the commercial fishing industry. But I think that's improving, and certainly, Chairman, the good news, and we'll report on this a little later, we're seeing our fishing participation increase in April and May, just like we hoped it would. So certainly hopefully that will continue on through the Memorial Day weekend. This is an important weekend for us if we hope for anglers to get into our waters. This picture shows the assemblage of state and federal waters that are closed. Louisiana controls their territorial seas out to 3 miles, I believe. And so this kind of shows you the extent of both the state and federal closure. You can see that most of that is aggregated in and around the mouth of the Mississippi River. Louisiana is doing everything they can to open every bit of water they can if they think it's safe and they can get fishing in those areas, so they're very, very focused on it. But that just shows the closures in the aggregate. There's been a lot of talk, I think y'all heard this in the media, about the loop currents, and is oil going to get into the loop currents and what that means. Those currents are very dynamic, very fluid. They fluctuate literally on an almost daily basis, and so they're a little hard to predict. But as you can see from that slide, that's the basic current that would transport oil eastward into the Atlantic through the Keys and over into the Atlantic side of Florida. There's a lot of concern about that. Now, if you just look at this way, I'm sorry I have to show you with this map. I'll try not to get anybody between eyes here. Basically, that oil spill is right in this area. And I'll show another map that shows a portion of the spill that's kind of approaching that current. Again, the concern is that it would be transported around the peninsula of Florida and past the Keys and into the Atlantic. There is another part of the loop current which takes oil back to the west. That's obviously one that typically kicks in June. And should we get any oil movement over here, then we got concerned about what that means for Texas. And again, we're certainly doing all we can to be prepared for that. This is the latest projected trajectory of the oil spill through May 28th. The trajectories that we get are on a three-day horizon. That is as accurate as they can get. Any more long-term projections are just simply not accurate. So just know that. The red shows where we've got beached oil on beaches and in marshes, a little over 50 miles or so of Louisiana coastline. Are we seeing, you know, oil in there? And this kind of shows you with the dark blue where the heaviest concentrations are right now in the Gulf, obviously very, very near the spill itself. This is the offshore projected trajectory. This shows that little strand that we're concerned about that may move into the loop current and may get caught up and be brought around the tip of Florida and the Keys. And so that has folks watching that very, very carefully. But I wanted to show you that little strand that's kind of broken off from the main aggregation of the oil. So what are the options that may be open to the commission if and when something specific or different should be done with respect to our management of commercial and recreational fisheries? We want to first and foremost protect the resource. We know that is your mandate to us. Also, we want to make sure, though, that if there is some need to change the rules or regulations to facilitate additional fishing opportunities, that you know what tools are at your disposal. With that said, basically everything has to go through normal rulemaking procedures with two exceptions. And so I want to just mention those. With respect to the Gulf shrimping season, in statute, that is open and closed with the approval of the executive director. Per our normal authority, we close the Gulf shrimping season May 15th. We typically close it for around 60 days. This allows the smaller brown shrimp to go out with the ebb tides into the Gulf and to grow, you know, three and a half inches, helps with juvenile recruitment into the population, and also allows those shrimp to get a little bigger so that they're more marketable. We have had some interest in asking the department to consider continuing the season. We don't feel that that's the right thing to do right now, and so we went ahead and closed the season for a number of reasons. But we do have the ability to open it back up with a 24-hour notice. So just wanted to let you know that. Also, I think a number of you will remember from last session that there was an interest in having some emergency rulemaking that was invested in the department in some kind of a natural disaster. This only goes into effect if the governor declares a disaster area for the state, and it does give specific emergency rulemaking authority. And let me just read to you what it says in code. If a disaster is declared by a governor, the commission or the executive director finds that there is an imminent danger to a species authorized to be regulated by the department, or that strict compliance with department rules would in any way prevent, hinder, or delay necessary action in coping with a disaster. And so there's a little statutory flexibility if something might need to be changed or looked at if the oil were to be moved this way, and y'all wanted us to look at some options. Again, that would only go into effect if the governor declares a disaster area. Again, at this time, our coastal fisheries team is strongly recommending that we hold the course. It's what other states are doing as well outside of Louisiana in order to protect that resource. We do have options available in all of these fisheries. Again, with the Gulf shrimp fishery, we can open or close that season early if need be. If warranted and we're concerned about excessive pressure coming into the Texas territorial seas, we do have the ability to remove the transferability of licenses. So if you have a shrimping license and it's sort of dormant and somebody wants to transfer that, sell that to another commercial fisherman in another state, if we're concerned about an abundance of pressure, we do have the ability to restrict that through that means. The Gulf Menhaden fishery is open right now. As you will recall, 2 years ago, the commission put into rule a total allowable catch of 31.5 million pounds, more or less, in Texas territorial seas. Because that total allowable catch was not met in full last year, there's a 10% allowance increase that y'all allowed us to build in, which is in effect now. So a little over 34 million pounds of menhaden can be caught this year. Again, that fishery is open right now. If the situation warrants, there is the possibility for closing the season early, or if you want us to consider increasing the total allowable catch, that is something that we can come back to you on. With respect to the inshore fishery, we're not expecting a lot of impacts. Again, remember, expecting weathered tarballs. We're not expecting a lot of movement through the passes. Most of these we expect will get hung up in the Gulf or on the barrier islands. The teams are looking at the efficacy of placing silt curtains. You know, you see those on kind of the highway, those black silt curtains along washover passes. So if you're going to have a hurricane or something else, there are tides that might roll through a washover pass, to see what you can do with the silt curtains to catch the tarballs. Standard booms aren't going to do it. They're just too buoyant. They're just going to float right over the booms. But we've got teams, for instance, at Sebring State Park that are looking at washover passes right now and looking at the efficacy of that if need be. So, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to share that update and just kind of let you know that we are in our team actively working on this on a daily basis. Again, we are very fortunate in terms of where we sit with respect to the majority of oil. Expect to get some at some time, but certainly right now we're not plagued with the challenges that our sister states are around the Gulf. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions about any of these matters.
Carter, let me ask a couple of questions. On the menhaden, why do you think the total allowable catch was not met last year?
It's a good question. You have a response to that, Michael Robin?
Yeah. For the record, Robin Riker, Director of Coastal Fisheries. The reason it wasn't met, or at least what we hear from the fleet, is, you know, they're centered in Louisiana, so if they can catch fish off of Louisiana, that's where they will do most of their fishing. And last year, they were able to catch and spend most of their time fishing in Louisiana. So they didn't really come over to Texas as much last year, and they were under by quite a bit. So, you know, that's really what it was. It was just when they can catch them closer to home, they're going to catch them there. So,
have our stocks increased as a result of the lack of the reduction in pressure, or do we know?
Well, it's really it's a Gulf stock that we're dealing with, so I wouldn't say that. You know, as we presented to you at the time, they're working on a new stock assessment. It should be upcoming in the current year. Now, given oil spill and all the things that have gone on, I'm not certain whether they're going to complete that in this year because they may have some difficulties in regards to NIMP scientists being pulled away from stock assessments and doing other things. But that, you know, total stock size is we wouldn't have expected it to change just because of them catching fewer in our waters last year.
Is there any concern that by raising the total allowable catch that we're defeating the purpose of it? Of imposing the ceiling in the first place?
The only thing I would say to that is obviously any of those options that we put up there were options, any less restrictive options associated with that whole suite of things was really directed at helping the fishery constituency because of kind of a larger impact to their overall Gulf opportunities. Certainly there's going to be some concerns and some worries and issues that we're going to have to discuss regarding the biological implications if we were to increase tack or change the season to allow more shrimp to be harvested. You know, obviously we may be part of the Gulf here that may be not as impacted as other parts, and so, you know, we're going to be real concerned in watching and making sure that we're not harvesting to a level that it's going to impact recruitment in other areas as well. So.
Last question, Carter. Are we keeping track of the costs we're incurring in connection with this spill, with the thought that we ultimately may have the opportunity to present that to BP for reimbursement?
I think that we absolutely are tracking that. I think, again, we have to see a more direct impact to Texas Waters before, we would be in a position to ask for reimbursement for that. But absolutely, we're tracking that. The other thing I should have mentioned that we're also doing are some baseline sampling, Commissioner, of invertebrates and fishery-related organisms to make sure we have a sense of where we are now versus if something were to change. And so that's an important part of this as well. So, but yeah, your point is well noted.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. That concludes my report. Thank you.
Any item number two, update on implementation of revisions to the exotic aquatic species rules.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski with the Inland Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to update you on staff's implementation of the revisions to exotic aquatic plant rules. Currently, Texas has CPWD has the authority to regulate exotic aquatic plants, and we do that by a prohibited list. Plants that have been deemed harmful or potentially harmed are listed in our rules, and those rules are approved by the commission. We do allow some plants, such as water spinach, to be possessed with an exotic species permit, and those permits have conditions that minimize the risk of those plants. There are some disadvantages to this system, bringing it before the commission, developing the information on it. That can be a lengthy process, and that can make it difficult to respond to new threats, new plants that are brought into the country, and that list possibly allows non-listed species to be established before we can declare them to be harmful. And this can lead to environmental damage and economic costs to treat those plants. Currently, our department spends about $1.2 million treating exotic plants, giant sylvania, which is one we've talked about a lot recently, has been causing us a lot of problems in East Texas, and the other two main species of concern are hydrilla and water hyacinth. In light of this, in the last legislative session, through the Sunset Bill, we were directed to develop a new way to regulate the exotic aquatic plants. Through that bill, we were directed to publish a list of exotic aquatic plants that are approved for use in Texas, which is 180 degrees different from the prohibited list. And then these rules that we are developed were to be as permissive as possible without allowing any plants that would pose problems in Texas. And finally, we were directed to have these new rules in place by January 1st of next year. Even though most of the focus recently has been on plants in freshwater, this does impact fresh and saltwater and our surrounding riparian areas. After the legislative session, we had assembled an interdivisional team of all the affected divisions, inland fisheries, coastal fisheries, law enforcement, legal, wildlife, and EO, and I'm sort of representing that team, but we've been working on this issue since last summer. And the goals for our team were to develop that list of aquatic plants that were approved in Texas and develop new rules to administer these new regulations. In the legislation, the exotic aquatic plants were defined as a non-indigenous aquatic plant that was not normally found in aquatic and riparian areas of the state, and for the purpose of this, we are including both vascular plants and algae in these regulations. One of the most crucial portions of this is the approved list and the criteria that we use to develop that list. The legislation contained some directives. We were to evaluate the plants for harm by our risk assessment models, any other published scientific research from other agencies or third-party labs, and the approved list must include plants that are widespread in the state and determined as through the risk analyses or other methods to not be harmful. We realized there were some challenges in going in this direction. Numerous plants have been in trade for years. There's not much information available on the life history of some of those plants. There's quite a bit of information on how you raise them in the aquaria, but sometimes that life history information is lacking. Another challenge was varieties of a particular species or group of plants, such as water lilies. Water lilies are native to Texas, but they're also found in other parts of the U.S. and the world, and they've been hybridized in various varieties, so we have to consider instances like that, including all the relevant stakeholders. Prior to this, we didn't have a lot of contact with people in this arena. We've been working on to develop that, both to get them the information on our new regulatory and also to get information back from them so we could determine what's being done in Texas. And another challenge has been the emergence of algae. Algae has some particular challenges for this. We've recently been contacted by ExxonMobil. They're considering doing an experimental project in the Baytown area to look into the use of algae for biofuels. As I mentioned, we've been working on this since last summer. In November, we put together a letter on our new regulatory direction and request for candidate plants. We are working on our stakeholder list. We contacted wholesalers, both in-state and out-of-state, various business, trade groups, organizations, both governmental, non-governmental, and various individuals to get this information out to them. And from this information, we began compiling that draft approved list. We did get some input from the public. We put together a draft list of 150 plants. Once we got that put together, we went back out to our stakeholders, or we tried to add some other important groups after that time. We also added, looked on the internet, found some of the aquatic hobbyist groups, people we hadn't contacted originally, groups in Austin or other cities that are just interested in raising aquatic plants, so we reached out to them, gave them information on this.
And is this the list of the prohibited plants or the permitted plants?
These are plants that would candidate plants for the approved list. We also scheduled 7 public input meetings around the state. We had those in Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, San Antonio, Corpus Christi, Brownsville, and El Paso. And we also posted this information on our website. And all the correspondence to this, we tried to inform people of the new regulatory direction, either gave them the draft approval list directly or gave them a link to that on our website, and we also tried to inform them of public meetings. From that, we've been gathering public input since then. At the public meetings, we had 32 attendees. And we did receive some support for the approved list, but concerns about the specific plants, such as I mentioned, water lilies, those are very popular plants, have a lot of economic impact. We're addressing that, and also about adding new plants to the list. The opposition that we received to the approved list were people saying we should maintain or not go in this direction or maintain the prohibited list, and based on the legislation, that's really not an option. We were directed by the legislature to go in this direction, so that's the direction we're proceeding at this time. And we did receive some additional candidate plans for our draft approved list. A crucial point here is the evaluation of those candidate plans. We're using a widely accepted risk analysis that incorporates factors on growth, climate, and adaptability, similar to some of the things we use for water spinach. And if that determination is made that the risk is low, the species will be placed on the draft approved list. Initial risk analyses are being done by TPWD staff in various divisions. And then we have arranged a contract with the Texas Invasive Plants and Pests Council to review our analyses to determine if they meet their rigorous enough. And so far we've...
Can I stop you on that?
Sure.
TIPPC?
Yeah, that's the Texas Invasive Plant and Pest Council.
Do I know who they are?
You probably don't, Chairman. Ken, you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah. I think the commission needs to know who these people are.
I think Earl Tilton probably could answer that.
Sure, Earl's been our representative with that. So, yep.
as well as I'd have to, we have somebody on this, and
sure,
and I'll be involved there.
For the record, my name is Earl Chilton, Kenlin Fisheries. The Texas Invasive Plant Pest Council is an organization composed of a number of different organizations. It has academics in it, has botanists from the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center in it. It's got people from the nursery industry in it, some folks from the aquarium industry. So basically, it's an organization composed of a wide range of people that have expertise in this field.
Are you on the council? Do you represent?
I represent Parks and Wildlife Department, and I'm on the board.
Yeah, Earl's been involved since its inception, one of the ones that helped create it.
I mean, sorry to ask you a question, but there are too many questions. But I mean, how did it evolve? Is it appointed, or is it? I mean,
it's almost like a professional organization, like the American Fisheries Society.
Okay.
But because it's a nonprofit, and they have a great deal of expertise on in invasive species, particularly plants, because the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center has a number of botanists on the board. So it looked like it was a really good place to get some expertise and some feedback.
Okay.
Chairman, we felt that it was really important to have a third-party review of our risk assessment. And because you have so many different stakeholders that are involved in TIPPC, that would be a good representative body to help look at this risk assessment. You've also got scientists that have got expertise or can get access to them. It was born out of the concern that we've all had about the proliferation of exotic species and wanted to get people together to try to deal with it more comprehensively in the state. And so that was kind of the genesis. And again, Earl's been involved since its inception. But I think they'll do a good job with the review and help provide, again, a little third-party review here.
Basically, some of the botanists from the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center are going to be doing the reviews.
Thank you.
And as I said, so far we've sent some of our risk analysis. We've transmitted about 50 of them. The staff is continuing to work on our risk analysis, and we hope to be finishing those up over the next month or so. After these reviews, we will put together that draft approved list and once again make that available for public comment. We're starting to work on developing the new rules to administer these new regulations, and we will, within those rules, we will provide a mechanism for adding new plants if people have that desire, and we also will maintain the use of some permits, exotic species permits for some plants. And in order to meet our January 1st deadline, we plan to come back to the commission at the August meeting and present the proposed rules with the draft approved list and at that time request permission to publish in the Texas Register, and then in November come back after we discuss public input with you and at that time request final input. And we're confident that once we get to the end of this process, this will give us a better mechanism to protect our environments from some of these threats that we're facing from the wildlife. And if you have any other questions or comments, I'd be trying to have that.
Hey, I think it's great that we're working with TIPPC on the risk assessments. But are we also checking with other southern states to see if they've been any kind of similar work and what their risk assessments might be, number one, and number two, whatever we end up doing, are we sharing our data with them so they might benefit from all the work that you and Earl and others are doing?
Well, we are checking with other states to see what they're doing as far as what approved lists or not approved lists. I don't know if we've gone out and see what type of analyses they've used. And we are collecting all this information we're submitting to TIPCC that would be available for other states to use. The risk analysis we're using is widely used and other agencies have used that. So,
but are we, for example, if Louisiana is undertaking a similar study, are we checking to see what their conclusions were to take that into account, whether we reject or accept it?
Yes, we've gone out and see what, you know, where determinations have been made of certain plants that have been ruled, you know, invasive in other states.
Earl Chilton again. We have checked with several other states. One of the states that I've checked with most has been California. California has developed their own risk analyses, and the person I talked to with California is one of their leading botanists who developed their risk analysis, and he's very comfortable with this one. In fact, he endorses this one for the kind of analyses that we're doing. We've also been working with a botanist out of Florida that is and she's been working also with the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center on this as well. But she's testing different risk analyses and was able to give us information about how accurate this risk analysis actually is and how accurate they anticipate it will be in the future.
Commissioner, there are very, very few states that have a whitelist process like what is being developed in Texas. I think Oregon and Hawaii, at least all or in part, have them. So there's a lot of attention and focus on Texas right now as we go through this. And so your comment about making sure that we export and share whatever information we glean as part of this is we absolutely will. There's just a lot of national attention in this right now because it's so unique.
And on the provision for adding new plants, is our view that we would go emulate this process in the future, go through the same steps, obviously it'd be a little quicker to add, but a similar process to vet.
Yes, we will do the same thing, and all those will have to be brought before the commission for your approval, and we will, you know, we will certainly write into the rules the procedures for doing that and the information that we'll request.
Thank you. Committee item 3, proposed seagrass conservation rules regarding the Redfish Bay State Scientific Area, recommended adoption of proposed changes.
Good morning. Ed Hagen, the Coastal Fisheries Division. I'm before you today to bring forth and remind you of the proclamation that we want to renew for the Redfish State Bay State Scientific Area. This is a kind of a condensed version of what you saw in March. A little history that we've been involved in seagrass management for about 20 years. Specifically, we want to address the State Scientific Area designation in 2005. It had a 5-year term. We've done about 4.5 years of extensive investigations, outreach effort, that type of thing. In 2006, we had a proclamation from the designation of the state scientific area which prohibited the uprooting of seagrasses by propellers. We've done, here's a slide of a typical propeller scar, and that's what we're addressing in the state scientific area. This is the Redfish Bay State Scientific Area on the mid-central coast, again, on the lower right, Port Aransas jetties, Corpus Christi ship channel on the lower, going to the left, Port Angeles side, the intercoastal waterway goes up to the upper right, just south of Rockport, and that big triangle, about 32,000 acres of submerged aquatic vegetation. The white dots are the boat ramp access sites. We used a number of techniques. We used in the water swimming of transects, 35 transects in upper and lower Redfish Bay, and counted scars over the last 5 years and saw a reduction in the number of scars crossing those transects. We also used high-resolution aerial photography. That in front of you is a comparison between 2005, 2007, 8, and 9, showing a reduction in the high-density areas of scarring, significant reduction in scarring. Hopefully based on our outreach efforts, education, those types of things that we've done to inform voters of the importance and value of the seagrass beds. You can see where the high-density scarring occurred and where it has been reduced over the last 3 years from the dense red. The conclusions of, if you remember, in March, a lot of the research and efforts and outreach efforts, these are the conclusions. Scarring is reduced. During our recovery study of scars, we found that scars are recovering faster than we had actually expected. from that aerophotography, you saw that there are some high-density areas of scarring. Those have also been reduced, but scarring is susceptible in some of the shallow areas of Redfish Bay, and our education outreach efforts are successful with all the media and news releases, as well as results from our human dimension surveys, in which we've gotten results from the users of Redfish Bay in responses to questions asking them whether they knew about the regulation, knew about the importance of seagrasses, and whether they've changed their behavior in fishing or not, in which they've indicated they have. So those, that education outreach covers that, the boat covers that area.
Can I stop you there? I want to address this on that. I just had to be down here this last weekend, and the education outreach, there's a lot of awareness. A lot of much higher awareness than a few years ago.
Yeah.
If you go down, and people really are, I think, trying to do the right thing.
I think there are
anything from changing their equipment to how they fish to where they fish to, you know, doing it in a different way, but just understanding what the scarring does and the issues it creates. I think y'all have done a very good job in education outreach.
I think we've had a lot of cooperation from news media magazines. Coastal Bend Bay's estuary, recently they restarted their public service announcements. You'll hear that during the weather and that type of thing in the local area. So we've had tremendous cooperation from those people who have methods to get that outreach to the public as well as their own.
And they just word them out, too.
Yeah. And of course, law enforcement has been on the water and issued some citations, a lot of education presence and warnings and things. As a result of the request to change the removal of the Redfish Bay State Conservancy had a 5-year term limit, and what we would like to do is remove that term limit so that the state scientific area stays into effect. It doesn't expire, and hence the proclamation does not expire. We had public hearings, and we had 54 people in support. One person was against these rule changes. The comments came from email, web, and public hearings in Lockport and in San Antonio. Commissioner Hughes attended a meeting in San Antonio. At that one, we had a spokesman submit a letter from the Coastal Conservation Association of Texas supporting our efforts in research and management in Redfish Bay. And we, as you see, unanimously endorsed by the Coastal Resource Advisory Committee meeting at their meeting. So I don't think there's any reason not to go forward with this. Any questions?
Sure, Doug. Ed, at the March meeting, Mr. Dixon suggested that we try to work with the guide associations and getting the brochures and the education material out, and I suggested that we make it available with boat registrations. Are we going to move forward on both or either of those fronts?
I think we looked at boat registration, and boat registration comes on a monthly cycle, and I don't know if we have the ability to send those brochures out on a monthly cycle. I'd have to defer to Robin on that one. I think we looked into that, and that was a little more difficult to process.
Well, and I think what Ed's referring to is early on, I think there was an attempt to link up with boat registration. We think we've gotten a little more sophisticated in our abilities here within the department now, computer-wise and so forth, and what we're going to try to do is go back and look at that again. Since there's such a focus of that San Antonio area, we think we probably can identify by zip those particular boat registrations and maybe try to put in a campaign that when it's going to those particular zip codes, we'll be sending that information to them as well. And certainly we're going to continue to work with those guide associations and those local interest in trying to get that word out. We'll, this isn't an effort that we stop now that we take the expiration date away. We have to continue that education outreach effort from now till through time. And the good news is these same boaters that are here also boat in other areas. And so when they learn these practices, they're carrying that seagrass conservation up and down the coast. So, this is just the beginning of the effort. It's certainly not the end. So,
maybe that leads to the next question. Are we going to expand this up and down the coast? Man, I've lost track of that. Right?
Well, and kind of as we discussed at the last meeting, we're going to certainly be, we've tasked our biologists to looking at other areas that are potential areas, and we're going to be looking at those, working with those communities, and trying to come back with you or to you with a set of recommendations of where we might go next.
Any other questions? Thank you. No further questions or discussions. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number four, Migratory Game Bird Proclamation Update. Dave Morrison.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner. This morning is Dave Morrison, and I have two presentations to give to you this morning. The first is kind of an update on the migratory bird regulations proposals that were presented at the last commission meeting, and the second deals with a request from the commission to provide an overview of what's going on with snow geese and continentally involved lakewood. At the last commission meeting, the Wildlife Commission presented proposals for all migratory bird hunting seasons for the 2010-2011 hunting season. At this time, we are here to tell you that we really appreciate very few comments, and we don't anticipate any changes to the proposals that were presented. Based on federal processes, though, the early season migratory regulations will have to be adopted sometime in July. We're not sure of the date yet. This will be the last time that you'll have an opportunity to see these days before Mr. Smith, in consultation with the chair of the commission, will have to select the days for Texas for the early season migratory species that include dove. So with that said, I'm going to kind of give you a quick overview of what the proposals were from last month. These are the seasons that are currently being considered for teal, rail, galinu, snipe, and woodcock. They're essentially calendar adjustments from last year. With respect to dove in the north and central zone, again, calendar adjustments, with probably the biggest change from last year would be opening the second split on Christmas Day. With Christmas falling on a Saturday, we're going to try to provide a full weekend of hunting that weekend. In the south zone, and especially light-winged dove area, these are the dates that have been proposed. Those dates in red are the first 4 days of the special white-winged dove area. The dates in blue represent where those two seasons overlap, and those dates in gray are the last 4 days in the south zone. Both zones will actually have a 7-day season, just how they're structured. For late-season species that include ducks, mergansers, coots, geese, and sandhill cranes, many of the surveys that help drive the decision are still ongoing, and we really don't know what to expect yet. But based on habitat conditions and what we're seeing, everything tends to lean towards having a liberal season for ducks for the 15th straight year. As a result, the dates that will be that have been presented are based on a liberal package for ducks, which is 74 days, and a conventional bag of 6 birds. The season for geese and sandhill cranes will be basically unchanged from last year. This will happen in our management unit season. These are the dates we proposed last month. This is a liberal package. It should be understood that the High Plains Mallard Management Unit can get up to an additional 23 extra days. The season that's shown here has a season length of 89 days. In the north and south zones for duck hunting, these seasons are essentially calendar adjustments from last year, and there's really no change, and it's also a 74-day season. Since we're in a liberal package, that means that Texas will probably be offered the opportunity to take a 6-bird conventional bag with the species and sex restrictions that are shown here. I do need to point out that, again, we'll be hearing that Texas will probably be held to hold a 5-day closure on what we consider a dusky duck, which is a mauve duck, black duck, and Mexican white duck. We're still not certain, but we will discuss that with the Service Regulations Committee at our upcoming meetings in Washington, and hopefully we can get them to back off of that. With respect to geese in the west zone, simply calendar adjustments will open on November the 6th and run through February the 6th. The daily bag limits are unchanged from last year. The conservation order would open the day after the duck the goose season closes and run through March the 27th. East zone, again, calendar adjustments. The one thing I do want to point out is the white-fronted goose season is shorter simply because the management plan calls for a 72-day season based on the numbers that were seen last fall. proposed place for Sandhill Crane in Zone A. That season structure will run concurrent with the West Zone dew season. In Zone B, we would open on the Friday after Thanksgiving and close on February 6th. The reason for the delayed opening is so that any grouping crane that are migrating through the state of Texas will be in and through that area before we open hunting season and avoid any potential conflicts. Zone C, we're taking advantage of the maximum 37 days that is allowed. We'll go from December 18th to January 23rd. That concludes this part of the presentation. We have to answer any questions we have on those proposals.
Dave, how do we know that the Coopers are through Zone B, for example, by November 26th? What's the basis?
Basically historical data and how they move through the country. And it's all based on history and how long they've typically gone through. And that is actually a little bit beyond what time they typically would pass through there. The second part of this presentation is kind of an overview of the mid-continent snow goose population. At the last commission meeting, we requested to give an update about what's going on. And what I'd like to do this morning is kind of give you an overview of both continentally and locally what's happening with snow geese since the implementation of expanding harvest opportunities back in the late 90s. First, a little continental background. The Arctic Ecosystem in Peril is a document that was published in 1997. What this document did, it recognized that snow goose numbers and white goose numbers were expanding. And also with this expansion, there was a population, there was a problem that was going to grow. And the reason for the expanding white goose populations can be tied back to agricultural practices in wearing areas and in migration quarters, essentially finding a lot more food for them across a large area of this country. And basically, they were no longer constrained by traditional flyway routes. Modern agricultural practices have continued to have contributed to this problem, but agriculture is not something that we want to deal with since we have our regulatory process. Now, there's some problems associated with this expanded population, particularly in the Arctic and the subarctic. Early spring foraging, when these birds hit that breeding ground, is very destructive to salt marshes and freshwater meadows. The removal of that plant material has resulted in hypersaline conditions, loss of organic material, and drying out of the soils. Add to the fact that these birds are very colonial and gregarious only adds to the problem. As a result of these expanded populations, the Canadian Wildlife Service and United States Fish and Wildlife Services initiated an expanded harvest program in 1997 to reduce the mid-continent population until the population reaches a size that prevents further damage and allows recovery of damaged areas. The whole intent of this expanded harvest opportunity was to avoid a catastrophic collapse of the coastal tundra ecosystem. Just a little bit of background here, just so you understand what we're looking at. There's two areas that have been looked at very extensively over the last 30 years. It's Carrick Lake and Laprouse Bay. Laprouse Bay is located just outside of Churchill on Hudson Bay. And just to give you kind of a point of reference, the snow geese at Laprouse Bay are part of the mid-continent population. The spring numbers have grown from 1.5 million in 1970 to more than 12 million today. Historically, they wintered along a very narrow strip of the coastal marshes of Texas and Louisiana. But you can see that orange represents where they're being seen now. When the Hudson Bay project started at Laprouse Bay, there were 2,500 breeding pairs. Today, there are over 60,000 pairs. Well, people ask the questions, have we met our continental objectives? One of the best ways we can look at this is through satellite imagery. And if you look at that photo, the red, blue, and yellow represent the biomass loss in 10-year increments starting from 1973 and in 2000. The green kind of gives a false impression of the remaining ecosystem because much of this vegetation is not usable by geese and other species. But pay particular attention to those red, blues, and yellows. You can see how it started along the coast, and through time, it's going inland. So those birds are expanding into places where they typically weren't before. These two photos kind of provide these are the photos that people have seen all along. The one on the left is a plot of intact salt marsh that was exposed before there was any damage caused by snow goose foraging. The unexposed habitat is barren and hypersaline. The photo on the right is a once intact salt marsh after the area was denuded of vegetation. What you see there, yes, is turning green. That's been over 20 years that that's been excluded, and that's how long it takes for this area to recover.
South Galapagos Bay,
degradation is extended all the way to the boreal forest where black spruce and tamarack are being killed because the soils are now hard to save. The habitat was once home to songbirds and grouse. Habitat degradation in Galapagos Bay is resulting in snow geese expanding from the historic Galapagos Bay, most of the way people leave crowded in urban areas. Galapagos Bay is up in the upper left-hand corner. Well, because they started seeing this expansion, they started doing increased monitoring of Walpus National Park, which is part along the Hudson Bay. In 2001, there appeared to have been a major influx of snow geese south of Lapras Bay, that area to the lower right-hand corner. And this is just an example of how these birds are shifting and adapting to the conditions. This shift has led to a level destructive foraging similar to those at this historic Lapras Bay research site. Oh, the present. There's no sign of abatement, and damage will continue into the foreseeable future. We're uncertain if current nesting and post-hatch locations are suitable for expanding populations. Now, if you ask yourself, will this problem continue to spread? Even more importantly, can we even begin to monitor the vast Arctic ecoregions? It's kind of an overview of the continental, and I'm going to try to bring it home a little bit closer to home. The information we'll provide is based on some midwinter surveys that we do. Our midwinter surveys for geese are part of a continental approach where the lower 49 states take a snapshot in time about the last week of December, first week in January. We survey geese based on concentrations, essentially from Beaumont to the southern tip to Texas. Now, our goose surveys differ from our aerial waterfowl surveys because they are actual counts for our waterfowl inventories or transects that we expand the numbers out. This is what historic midwinter estimates show from 1978 to 2010. The yellow line represents what our long-term average is. So you see from the late 70s to the late 90s, we were off along there about 700,000, 750,000. We did see a peak in 1999, which corresponded to the first year of expanded harvest opportunity and a 20-bird bag limit. Since then, you can see that the numbers have been declining downward, and we're now below what the long-term estimate is. We're pointing out that, yes, there was an increase this year, but those numbers come on the heels of one of a severe cold snap that pushed about every snow goose in Central Florida into Texas. This is just to give you a different time frame so you can see a comparison of 1993 to 2010 in Texas compared to another population on Carrick Lake. You can see, pay attention particularly to the line with the black dots, you can see what's going on Carrick Lake with respect to nesting geese from 1993 to 2010. So we have two different problems. We have a problem in Texas that it appears that on the coastal and rice prairies of Texas, snow geese numbers appear to be on the decline. But continually, there is no end in sight to these birds continuing to increase. About harvest nests. Texas is known as a goose hunting state. So when this expanded harvest opportunities were put in play, who was in the best position to take advantage of it? Texas was. So you can see in 1999 when it started, we killed a bunch of geese that year. And since then, our harvest has declined to a point that is very similar to what it was back in the late 70s through the mid-90s. Even though we've had an increase in backlog up to 20 birds per day, what our information shows that 93% of the people that hunt geese kill 5 or less per day, with 50% killing only 1 per day. So even with the expansion of the up to 20 birds, both of the hunters can't kill but less than 5. Our goose hunter numbers in Texas since 1999 have been stable to slightly decreasing. And if you take a look at the white goose conservation season hunter numbers, you can see in 1999, the very first year, we had about 27,000, 28,000. That number has declined. In the most recent survey, we've got about 2,500. As a result of the decline in hunters during conservation order, our harvest has also declined as part of that conservation order. The very first year, we killed 100,000 plus. Now we're killing around 15,000 in that season.
Why is this happening?
I'm sorry?
Light goose conservation season, hunter numbers, why are they dropping off?
Lack of interest. Honestly, lack of interest.
Bored.
It was fine at first, and then it just said, okay.
We're done that.
Yes, sir. Pretty much. To summarize, the continental populations of white geese appear to continue to be increasing. Texas numbers are on the decline in the coastal regions and the large prairies, and we as an agency need to continue to monitor and determine what, if any, proposals need to be brought forward. I would like to point out that we have made an attempt to an online survey to gather some information. To be very honest with you, that survey was up for about 35, 40 days. We only got 345 responses. So the information we have, we're not real sure what it tells us. Add to the fact that some of the recent information coming out from Human Dimension workshops is not very flattering towards online surveys, so I have opted not to present that information because we're not certain that it has any real validity. With that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Good presentation, Jeff. Any questions?
You say the continental numbers are increasing, but ours are declining.
Yes, sir.
Does that mean that these birds are going to other states because there's less hunting pressure? Food? I mean, that doesn't seem to be, it seems incongruous that the overall continental numbers are going up, but ours are going down.
Yes, sir. That is a much longer presentation I wouldn't bore you guys with, but when you take a look at places like Kansas, Arkansas, Missouri, Iowa, Louisiana, you can see those numbers are increasing. You can also see, based on midwinter data, that the percentage of geese are counted in the central flyway is trending downwards, whereas the number of birds counted in midwinter surveys in the Mississippi flyway is trending upwards. So there appears to be some shifting of these birds. Kansas last year, on the Quivira in December, they had something like 400,000 subjects. That's unheard of in Kansas. Add to the fact that Kansas, during their goose season, for white geese, they killed 10,000-15,000. But they were wintering a lot of birds. So it is a shifting of these birds. There's a lot of things going on. Agriculture has changed. Why did geese want to fly any further south? They got all the groceries they want where they're sitting. This year was a little bit different because we did have some substantial cold fronts that did force those birds into Texas in late December and early January. But the changes in the landscape is what's driving these birds now.
Okay, committee item number 5, deer management permit rules, DMP, 10 requirements and release provisions, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Mitch Lockwood.
Oh, you're
leaving.
Yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood, and I am the White Program Leader and Acting Vigilant Program Director. This morning, I will review our proposed rule changes for the Deer Management Permit, or DMP. This is a permit that allows one to trap up to one buck and 20 does from a high-fence track and detain those deer for a period of time for natural breeding purposes only. The underlying concern for many with this permit and the issues that we'll discuss today is the need to maintain a clear distinction between the deer breeder permit and the deer management permit, because the deer breeder permit pertains to or applies to pen-raised deer, whereas the DMP applies to wild-caught deer that are detained for an extended period of time, but not indefinitely. The purpose of this permit is quite simple. It's to increase the reproductive success of a single buck. Conceptually, this is simple to do. You remove competition. So in practice, what a lot of people do is they attempt to remove that competition through aggressive harvest, removing all the bucks that they don't want contributing to that population and leaving only those top-end or top-quality bucks in a population. But others find it more efficient to go out and capture a superior buck and to pin that deer with up to 20 does to ensure and increase his reproductive success. These deer may be released soon after breeding, or they may be detained for a longer period of time, allowing those does to drop their fawns in the pens and raise them for a short while prior to being released. Under current rule, the final date at which deer may be released from the DMP facility is August 31st. rule requires that a DMP be at least 5 acres in size and no more than 100 acres in size. This program has evolved over the years and now allows for pens smaller than 5 acres, provided that those pens have adequate cover, which is defined as 50,000 square feet of continuous natural vegetation.
Copy there.
Yes, sir.
From 5 to 100 acres is a requirement to have a minimum of 50,000.
Current rule has no cover requirement for pens that are 5 acres or greater.
No cover.
That's correct.
That's
and I may just elaborate on that at this time. That exception that you see in the second bullet, of course, is something that, appears through time as this permit has evolved. Initially, cover requirements really weren't considered, is my understanding. There was just a thought that a pen size should be between 5 and 100 acres, assuming that there would be cover. But as this has evolved, allowing for smaller pens, it became quite clear that those pens could be considered, but only if there was adequate cover. Now, an unintended consequence of this rule is what you just mentioned, Mr. Chairman, that it does allow for some pens with no cover. And this certainly does not provide a good environment for wild white-tailed deer. The reason for this cover requirement, I think, is quite obvious. It's to reduce the stress on these wild deer and to minimize the chances of them bouncing into fences and getting hurt, potentially killing themselves. Therefore, we have proposed to require that all DMP pens contain at least 50,000 square feet of cover in the form of natural vegetation. Additionally, we proposed to repeal that exception to that 5-acre minimum pen size requirement. And the reason is that that exception allows for pens that are just over 1 acre in size, 1.1 acres. And I think everyone who has provided comment or input on this proposal has agreed that 1.1 acres simply is not enough room for 21 wild white-tailed deer. Now, as I think many of you are aware, there's been quite a bit of discussion over the past few weeks, both internally and externally, with feedback we're receiving on how much space is required for 21 deer. And I'm sure it's no secret that I don't have that magic number. We don't have some good, or we're not aware of any good scientific data out there that suggests X amount of space is required for a specific number of deer. I'm sure it depends on a variety of factors, such as the deer population itself, habitat types, the cover types and availability, perhaps distribution of food and water, any number of factors. And so with that in mind, when Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee discussed this item, and going over these different options that could be considered, they recognize that we already do have a standard in place with a 5-acre minimum pen size requirement and recommended that we just stick with that and with no exceptions. Now, when we discussed this in March at this Regulations Committee meeting, we had some discussion on what I'll call a grandfather clause. I think amongst this committee there may be some other thought as to whether it's grandfathering or exemption or what the right term is. For the purpose of my presentation this morning, I'll refer to it as a grandfather clause. But what we talked about was grandfathering those who currently have a deer management permit and maintain an active permit through time. As soon as that permit were to lapse a year, then that permit would no longer be grandfathered. And we also talked about permitting the child or spouse who inherits a facility that has been grandfathered. This is another item that's been discussed quite a bit since we met in March, and we received a lot of feedback questioning why we would not include those in this grandfather clause that had a permit, say, 2 years ago, as opposed to last year. Or while we wouldn't consider those with a permit, who are currently building new facilities under our current rules. And we've thought about many other options of how this grandfather clause could work. And to be quite honest, I see it getting very complicated. I'm thinking about my staff who issue these permits and what kind of administrative burden we may be asking for. And so, having said that, I would like to propose an alternative approach for this grandfather clause this morning. I visited with staff about this, including our general counsel, and we believe this is a logical outgrowth of what was published in the Texas Register. And that is that if the facility standards that are proposed are adopted, that again being a minimum of 5 acres for these pen sizes, and all pens having at least 50,000 square feet of cover, if that is indeed adopted, that it take effect on September the 1st of 2011, the beginning of the 2011-12 permit year. And with that, then anybody would be grandfathered at that time would be those that have a permit in the 2010-2011 season, which is this upcoming DMP season. So with that, that would give us an opportunity to again publicize this approach, make sure constituents out there are aware of this approach, that if they want a permit in 2011 or beyond, they need to get one in 2010 to be grandfathered. So that's a new concept that I present this morning, and a new approach, and would like for that to be considered if we were to grandfather anyone with this facility standard adoption. I know you're all also aware of the final main item of discussion that has generated quite a bit of talk over the last more than the past year, and that is the release date for being detained under DMP, which is currently August 31st. There are a few permittees in South Texas who have observed very low fauna survival in their DMP operations the last few years, and they attribute this to this release date. They believe that the fauna survival would be greater if they were allowed to hold on to those deer for a little bit longer, let those fauna be older, be bigger upon release, and I believe that would improve fauna survival. As we discussed in March, we're not aware of any scientific data out there that indicates that one release strategy has results in higher fauna survival than another release strategy. But it has been this commission's policy to provide landowners with the flexibility needed to effectively manage wildlife populations, while this department provides technical guidance to help those landowners achieve their goals for the benefit of those natural resources. And so with that in mind, this commission authorized staff to publish a proposal allowing for a modified release date, which reads that all deer within a DMP pen shall be released on or before the date specified for the facility by the department. We intend for that release date to be a date 45 days prior to the latest capture date of the subsequent permit year. As I said in March, it sounds a little bit complicated. I think I can explain it or simplify it some with this next slide or two. But you may recall we have a trapping deadline for trapping deer under the authority of the DMP. And this deadline varies by ecoregion. It's based on our breeding chronology data that we have. And these dates that you see on the slide before you are the last dates in which there's not a high probability of capturing pregnant does, bred does. Because again, the intent of this permit is for natural breeding purposes. And so the idea that we have in mind here, before I get that far, I think it would be wise at this time to address a public comment that some, if not all of you, are aware of that we received in recent days challenging these breeding chronology results. There's a couple of different models that you can use to determine conception date based on the length, the measurements of these fetuses. And when we did this study, there were a couple of models at that time. We chose to use the older of those two models because we needed to compare these conception dates to our data that we collected about 20 years prior in our first breeding chronology study. And at that time, there weren't two models, to my understanding. And so to make that comparison to see if we have had some changes in conception dates in these different ecoregions, we needed to use the same methodology, same techniques. Having said that, our researchers at that time actually ran these measurements through both models. and they found that the differences in conception dates between the two models was negligible. We're talking very, very few days difference between the two. If we were to run all these data today through this newer model, you would likely see some slight changes to these dates on this slide before you, but I'm talking a difference of 1 to 2 to maybe 3 days difference on some of these. So our idea here is to utilize these dates that we've obtained from our broom chronology data and continue using those for traffic deadline, but then subtract 45 days from those dates to establish a release date, as you see here. So using South Texas Plains as an example, where the trapping deadline is December 14th, you subtract 45 from that, you end up with a release deadline of October the 30th. That gives people in South Texas an additional 2 months to hold fawns in their facilities prior to release. This approach would achieve a few objectives. Number one, it would allow them to hold deer in captivity for a longer period of time. It would also allow these permittees up to 15 days to capture deer that following year. Let me explain what I mean by that. Our current rules require that upon release, once the DNP facility is opened up, the gates are open and must remain open for at least 30 days. And the artificial food and water must be removed for that same period of time. And so if one were to take full advantage of this proposal in South Texas released deer on October 30th, then those gates would have to remain open for a month, and that would leave approximately 2 weeks of trapping deer that following year to meet this December 14th deadline, which is plenty of time. They certainly don't wait to schedule their helicopters, and so that does provide time. So this proposal still provides them about 15 days to catch deer that next year. And then it also would prevent 2 years of breeding of the same deer held under a single permit. It would minimize risk of lion breeding, for example. And I think this to some extent addresses that underlying concern I addressed earlier in this presentation of many in needing to maintain that clear distinction between a deer breeder's permit and a deer management permit. So in summary, we recommend that all deer management pens do contain at least 50,000 square feet of cover in the form of natural vegetation. We also recommend that all DMP pens be at least 5 acres in size, no greater than 100 acres in size. And with respect to this, what I call a grandfather clause, we recommend that the facility standards shown in those first two bullets above become effective September 1st, 2011. And at that time, grandfather will exempt those who have a permit in 2010 and 2011 permit year. And I should clarify something right now, too. When I said permit the individual, we mean for the facilities that are permitted in the 2010-2011 season. This wouldn't allow someone to 3 years later add a 3-acre pen to the facility. It wouldn't grandfather something like that. Or that's not even grandfather, but it wouldn't allow one to add that, make that addition. And then and continue with the idea of allowing for a child or spouse who inherits the property to be exempted as well. And then finally, we recommend that the release date is extended as I described in this presentation. One other thing that I should mention at this time is that as a result of any extension to the release deadline, then the permit year would have to be modified as well. We couldn't allow one to detain deer for longer period of time than the permit year, which currently ends, I believe, on August 31st. But because of where this falls in Texas Administrative Code, this will be proposed in the following presentation by Scott Baca and Brad Chappell. Public comments to date, we have 137 comments. In fact, this morning when I look, it's now 142 comments. The percentages that I'm about to show you have not changed, though. 58% of those agree completely with this proposal. 19% disagree completely with this proposal. And then 23% disagreed specifically on one aspect or another. And I wanted to display this way because the way the public comment went out for this item this year didn't break it up by pin size, cover requirements, and release date. It was all one proposal. Fortunately, the people who disagreed did take advantage of the comment fields and explain why they disagreed. And what we found out was, in almost all cases, if they supported the deer management permit, then those who disagreed, disagreed because they didn't think we should limit the pin size to 5 acres or greater. There were some comments about how it's easier to work deer in smaller than 5 acre pens, even a comment about easier to tame deer in smaller pens, and some comments that were a little bit inconsistent with, or rather consistent with that concern of maintaining that clear distinction between deer breeder permit and a DMP. There were quite a few other comments, though, that for various reasons just didn't think that was practical or necessary to reduce that pin size. We have almost, in fact, every comment that I saw for those in favor of a deer management permit in general did support the later release dates. I keep qualifying that because some of these comments that you see in here, especially those disagree, do not agree with this practice.
Right.
There was even a comment or two under the agree completely who agreed because they saw this as putting more sideboards on the permit, which they thought were required because they weren't too keen on the program either. But I'll also state that by far most of the comments were supportive of the deer management permit program. And finally, some comments that we received were that this simply is over-regulating. And then there were a few comments pertaining specifically to the grandfather clause. One idea is that we should not limit the exemptions to those children or a child or spouse of a permittee, but also allow anyone who were to purchase that property, change of ownership, for those people that they grandfathered as well. That was one comment we received. And then finally, we received some comments that there shouldn't be a grandfather clause at all, with the thinking that if this practice is smaller pens or no cover is not acceptable for new permits, then why on earth would it be acceptable for older permits? And I believe that wraps up the general sentiment of most, if not every, comment we received. And so with that, I'll conclude my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions or comments that you might have.
And just real quick question, if we can go back to the breeding chronology study and the release deadline. As an example, on South Texas Plains, release date of October 30th, sorry, trapping deadline of December 14th, about what percent of those are bred, you know, just based on the studies that we have available now?
On December the 14th, it's right at 10% or less of those have been bred. On December the 15th, it spikes. And it increases at a very rapid rate from the day after this one.
And then the median is about the 24th or 5th or something.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. So, and that would be consistent with the trapping deadlines, probably, give or take, for all of the eco regions?
Absolutely. This date you see here are just that. It's the last date in which 10% or less of the does have been bred. But again, that very next day is when it really starts to spike.
Okay, and then can you speak a little bit to what, you know, when the biologists establish the number of deer for a given pen, obviously they take into consideration a whole host of factors, but maybe you can just talk about that a little bit. Certainly vegetative cover would be one.
Well, to my
establish that number.
To my knowledge, you're right. Biologists do have the authority to approve a certain number of deer. And theoretically, we could approve a smaller number of deer, fewer deer than what the applicant is applying for. To my knowledge, we really haven't applied that. I believe in every case where someone has requested 21 deer, we have approved it for that number and not fewer. I could be wrong. There might be a few exceptions that I'm not aware of. That is something that we might need to take into consideration as we move forward with all of the interest and discussion that we've had on this topic. And also what we've learned from many permittees. I think this is something that we can use our technical guidance program for as we're working with landowners and we're learning from DMP permittees at 21 deer. There are not many of them doing that anymore as they're learning. They're having more success with 14 does, 15 does. And they're sharing that with potential permittees, and we're able to share that information as well as we learn it. So there's a lot of value for having the relationship we do with these different permittees that we deal with, and there's one good example.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Do we have any data on the mortality and pen size? Is there a greater mortality, smaller DMP pens as opposed to 5 acres or bigger, or do we know?
That's a very good question. I looked into that last week. I'll start by telling you we have very low mortality data. I assume that we have data for all the mortalities that have occurred in the last 5 years. That's as far back as I looked. And in the last 5 years, we've had a total of 40 mortalities across the board, statewide, in DMP facilities. This current year that's coming to an end, people are getting close to the original release deadline. We've had 10 mortalities, I believe it is, for this year. For this year, Commissioner, what we had to do to answer that question for myself is go back in paper files and hand enter the data. And it took quite a while, so I just stopped for this year because I was convinced after I saw that. From this year, of all 10 mortalities, zero of those reported came from pens smaller than 5 acres. They all came from larger pens. I don't know how true that is for the 4 years prior to that, but the number of mortalities is so negligible that I wouldn't be able to defend statistically any other response that I'm giving now. It does not appear from that limited data set that the pen size has resulted in higher mortality.
I guess the other question, follow-up question, do we know how many pens, what percentage are we talking about that are 5 acres and bigger in the state versus smaller than 5 acres? Do we know that?
I hope you don't get much deep in your questions because I didn't bring my printout with me, but I do know that answer.
So, I'm
just kidding. I just hope I'm able to continue answering this. Well, look at there. But I know that's 35% of all pens are less than 5 acres in size. 65% of 5 acres or more. And that's out of a number of 318 pens. And that was for the 2009 and 10 season. I looked at the 2008 and 9 season as well, and the numbers are almost identical percentage-wise.
And about the same number total.
There were a few more pens in 2008 and 9 than there were this current year, but it's not a whole lot more. Percentages, though, really didn't change. So a little more than a third of all pens are smaller than 5 acres. I also looked at, if we had no grandfather clause, who would be affected, how many people would be affected by this rule change, and there would be 17 people that had a permit in 2008 and 2009 that would not meet these new standards that did not have a permit in 2009 and 10. Now, that statistic, it would become a moot point if we were to proceed with the concept of making this effective September 1 of 2011 and grandfathering everybody permitted this upcoming season.
You said last time that more than one facility can be listed on a permit. Is that right?
Yes, defining a facility, the term facility and pen is used synonymously, and so one permit may consist of numerous pens or facilities.
How do we go forward with this without tying a permit to a particular facility?
Actually, I think what we're going to have to do is tie, not, I'd say it backwards of that, tie a facility to a permit. I think, just to give you an example, I received a permit today for a place that would like to have 5 pens permitted under one permit. I think what we need to do, which would not require a regulation change, is for each one of those pens to have its own facility ID, so that we can allow a database to track these pens through time, so that our staff doesn't have to go in subsequent years and pulling out paper files to say, okay, was this one grandfathered or not? If we have a facility ID for that site, then that database will be able to keep track of that through times. So, in a nutshell, I think what it's going to require is that we do establish a facility ID for every single DMP pin out there in the application process. Then we can identify them.
Okay. And then your recommendation about the alternative is this take effect September 1, 2011. It concerns me that creates a period of time where people can go build new pens that don't have the 50,000 square feet of cover. Would you be receptive to the suggestion that if the pen were constructed from today forward, that it has to have the 50,000 square feet of cover in order to be grandfathered? Before you answer that, let me say that looking at the statute that authorizes these permits, 43601B, and it says the deer managed under the permit remain the property of the people of the state, and the holder of the permit is considered to be managing the population on behalf of the state. So the consensus seems to be that we have to have 50,000 square feet of cover, and I just would like to hope that we could encourage that for any pens built from now through the cutoff on the grandfather date, if that's good.
I had struggled with this one, Commissioner, because I think what I proposed this morning with that grandfather concept is may defeat the purpose to some degree for the reason you gave with a mad rush of applications and new pen construction. To be quite honest with you, the main thought that I have in my mind with this idea is to find the most efficient way to administer these permits without requiring an administrative nightmare for staff. I like the idea that you just suggested. I can't work it out in my mind as to how much more that may complicate the process for those who are receiving these applications and issuing the permit and verifying when the permit was complete, when the pen construction was completed. Going through another step or two maybe to make sure that person is able to defend that. Maybe I'm digging way too deeply in this and it's a lot simpler than I'm thinking. That's my only concern is administrative time.
Do we currently require a site inspection as a part of the process for
approval? We do have site inspections, yes, sir.
So it could be part of that.
Let's go back. How many permits total do you have right now?
This current year we have 134 permits, which includes 318 pens.
Just to remind everybody that this is not capital or something. You know, we're not talking about. Thousands of people aren't going to run out and build 5-acre pens between now and September 2011. That's all
right. But my question doesn't concern the existing ones. I'm just saying that if someone commences construction on a facility, say, from June 1 forward, in order to take advantage of this proposed grandfathering, that new pen has to have a minimum of 50,000 square feet of cover. I'm suggesting we consider that as a part of this alternative concept. If it's practical, it seems to me, why it should be a big problem, but That's why I'm throwing it out for discussion.
I think it is a good thought. Personally, another reason why I lean towards the concept I presented this morning is because I do realize that these permittees, they want what's best for the deer too. They have a lot invested in this resource. They may not agree with other deer managers in the state on how to manage deer, but they do have a lot invested in this and would lose a lot if they had high mortality in these pens. And so I think that they certainly have the same interest that others have in taking care of the deer. And so having said that, those that don't have enough cover through time, I think has been more a factor of ignorance, for lack of a better phrase. And as they're learning more and talking from the veterans and have been doing this for a while now, what makes a good operation, I think we're seeing that people are selecting better sites for these pens. So I think it's another factor of using a technical guidance program and benefit from other permittees to have good site selection.
I don't have any problems with the 60,000 square foot cover. I don't have any problems with the release date, but you haven't convinced me of the size, and we haven't even considered numbers. And in your discussion this morning, it seems like those two are, you've cited some information that is important, so how do you convince me that a smaller size is better, if assuming that we agree on the 50,000, and assuming we agree on the release date, why should a pen be smaller, and why haven't we considered limiting the number of deer per pen or per square foot?
Well, I'm not suggesting, Commissioner, that the pens be smaller. This is something I think I touched on or meant to touch on in the presentation, is that everybody has an opinion. In fact, some of the public comments we received, we realize 1.1 acres is not enough, but 3 acres is. I can do it with 3. I hear that 2.5 acres is the magic number. I hear that 4 acres is the number, and then there's some that think 10 acres isn't enough. And as I tended to say, I don't know how much space is required for X number of deer. And I do believe that that number varies greatly by cover types, habitat types, and other factors that are involved there. And so what this proposal entails is basically maintaining the standard that's already in place, which was the recommendation of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. But again, that's not to say that 7 acres isn't required or that 3.5 acres wouldn't work just as well. It's the answer to the numbers of deer that are permitted, I think, is no different than my response to pen size. They're related. Should it be 15 deer? Should it be 12 deer? Should it be 6 deer? And again, there's not really any good data out there to suggest one way or another as far as the welfare of the animal. Now, the permittees do have some pretty good information, what they've learned through time and what works best for them and their operations, and what results in 100% conception for the does that are in there. And there's a number of them that lay that magic number as 14. Some believe it's 15. And I haven't heard that number change, whether it's a 2.5-acre pen or a 5-acre pen. And so, again, there are some thoughts as to the best number of does that would allow for maximum conception, but I don't have good information as to the number of deer that would be best for the overall welfare of those animals.
And you raise a good point. It's in their best interest, and they want to do the right thing. Deer breeders do. So, questions on... Does that answer your question? Where are we there?
Yeah, because it seems like we're there's some vagueness to the pen size. We may be trying to change.
Are you talking about density in the pen? Is that kind of the one that where we right now we're really not looking at specific densities?
Yeah, I think that may be it, because it seems like those two numbers are related, and that may be a more important thing is if you're going to have a pen size of 3 acres, then should you limit the number here in those 3 acres?
Well, we're, as wildlife biologists, think we're pretty well trained in coming up with good density estimates with respect to habitat quality and whatnot. And certainly 3 acres is nowhere near enough land for one white-tailed deer from that perspective. But we're not, or I'll speak for myself and say that I'm not well trained in the field of animal husbandry or animal welfare. And so, I really don't have a good answer to defend a certain pen size with a certain number of deer over another from an animal husbandry or welfare point of view.
You know, Commissioner, I think Mitch made an excellent point at the outset of this. The genesis of this program was to try to maximize the reproductive success of one buck with wild does. And so it was set up for that purpose, and is why he's referencing the animal husbandry standard. As he said, it's never really been tied to traditional ways that we would encourage landowners to manage their deer densities outside of a penned environment. And so that's the real distinction here.
And we're really not aware of any, in areas we're really not aware of any significant mortality issues.
That is correct.
The same thing I understand is we don't have great science about density, what size pen you need relative to how many pens you have in the pen. That's part of our issue. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
I think that the proposed language, I'm moving off this topic onto some of the language. We use the word person here, and I suggest that we make clear at some point that person is a term that's used in the Code of Construction Act, which includes entity, because some of these people may own it as an entity. And that when we talk about the grandfather language, that we track entity through here so that it can be passed on from an entity to, for example, an entity that's controlled by a spouse or a child.
Right.
So we don't defeat the purpose of this, which is a direct transfer. And it also should not be limited, in my view, to inheritance. It could be a sale from a parent to a child over a period of time through a safe plan. So I think that's consistent with the intent that we were all talking about on transfers.
I agree.
And I gave some language to Ann on that, and I think she's okay with it.
Okay. Any other thoughts or questions? Are you comfortable with the recommendation as is? Any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify, our recommendation was to provide this compliance window, and so for it to go into effect September 1 of 2011, and that would be the recommendation we're bringing forward to y'all tomorrow to consider. Is that still the direction that you have for us?
Yes. I see it, yes.
Well, good point. Thank you, Clayton. The only part, and I did stress this on the record, I know, the part that we would like to take effect on September 1, 2011 just pertains to facility standards. We propose that the release date be modified effective immediately. And just to elaborate on that, if that is effective immediately, our intention is to modify or amend existing permits that are out in the field right now to allow them to go ahead and release this year's deer later. That's the document.
Yeah, good point.
Okay. Make sure that's clear tomorrow, though, as you take action.
Okay. I think we can have a slide, Mitch, that just hits that specifically on the release date as to the timing of that would be in effect, assuming it's approved immediately for existing permit holders.
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, one slide that also comprises everything that we're contemplating. Yeah, so it's all on one.
Yes.
As well. Okay. Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
If there are questions or discussion, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. deer permit program rule standards for denial, refusal to renew, inclusion of Lacey Act violations, recommended adoption of proposed changes.
Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Scott Baca. I'm Assistant Chief of Wildlife Enforcement. Joining me this morning is Sergeant Investigator Brad Chappell. We're here to present some proposed amendments to the Triple T, DMP, and Jim Breeder permit rules. Current department rules allow denial of permit issuance or renewal for 5 years following conviction or deferred adjudication for violating certain subchapters of Chapter 43 Parks and Wildlife Code. Specifically, these subchapters are Subchapter C, which deals with scientific research, educational display, zoological collection, and rehabilitation permits. Subchapter E is the Triple T permit, and that is trap, transport, and transplant game animals and game birds. Most people think of it as a deer Triple T, but it is game animals and game birds. Subchapter L, deer breeder permit, and subchapter R, which is the deer management permit. Additionally, a conviction or deferred adjudication for a Class A or B misdemeanor or felony, or a conviction for violating 63.002, which is possession of live game animals. And if you'll note the asterisk, that denotes that it applies to a person acting as an agent for a permittee as well. The proposed rules will allow the department to deny permit issuance or renewal following a final conviction or assessment of a civil penalty for violating the Federal Lacey Act. And to discuss the Lacey Act more in depth, I'm going to turn it over now.
What drove this? We've been talking about it long enough now, I've lost track of what drove this to begin with. Is it because other states are doing this? Is it because we felt it was something that's been a problem? Walk me through it. Somebody.
Chairman Holt, we've had a recent history in the last 5 or 6 years of several importation issues involving live white-tailed deer into Texas in violation of our importation restrictions that have resulted in Lacey Act convictions. And at the same time, although there was no prosecution at the state level for those offenses, basic elements for a state offense had to be proven in order to make a case as prosecutable as a Lacey Act violation. And in essence, the violations, even though there was no state conviction, the offense had to occur in order to obtain a conviction at the federal level. If, as opposed to pursuing it federally, those cases would have gone to state court and we would have achieved a conviction in violation of our proclamations which prohibit importation, the department would already have the justification and authorization to non-renew those permits. And that's kind of what started the interest in doing so. The more that we looked at it and associated with the flagrant activities associated with Lacey Act convictions, if they raised to that level, to be handled by prosecutors with U.S. Attorney's Office, we felt like that it was probably something that the department would be interested in knowing about and taking into consideration for possible denial of permit issuance and renewals. For the record, I am Sergeant Game Warden Brad Chappell with Special Operations Unit of the Parks and Wildlife Department. The Lacey Act is a federal law that was enacted in 1900 which was established to help deal with the excess market honey, contributing to a drastic decline in wildlife populations. Basically, the act prohibits trade in wildlife, fish, or plants taken, possessed, transported, or sold in violation of state laws, as well as federal or tribal laws. The act makes it a violation to engage in prohibited activity, and convictions may be obtained without state prosecution, kind of along the lines of what I was stating. You have to show that there was a state offense occurred as part of the elements for establishing it as a predicate, actually, in order to pursue prosecution for the Lacey Act.
But a Lacey Act conviction can be obtained without state prosecution.
Yes, sir.
So you don't have to.
But there's a lot of conviction to that. Now I'm going back to the second sentence here, second bullet point. The act prohibits trade, et cetera, or sold in violation of state law.
Yes, sir. You have to have a violation of the state law. The Federal Lacey Act, as it's applied, has to be predicated or based on a violation of state law first, and then once the animal is transported or possessed, after it is established that the fact is established that it was possessed or taken unlawfully, or then it can be handled as a Lacey Act case. If you don't have a state level case to it has to be involving interstate commerce once you establish that it was illegally possessed or illegally taken as a base for the offense.
If it's not illegally taken, then how does it become a violation of the Lacey Act? Through the interstate commerce?
You have to have a predicate case first.
You have to have a predicate case.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, that doesn't mean there's a conviction.
No, I don't understand that.
Okay. Basically, you'd have to be able to prove the same elements for the state offense,
right,
in state court, and carry that same information, same evidence into the federal court system.
Okay.
That kind of is a base for the Lacey Act.
Yes.
Okay. Persons convicted in federal court are convicted of violating a federal law. Unless Texas Parks and Wildlife seeks prosecution at the state court level, Texas Parks and Wildlife Wild Rules concerning permit delay for trap, transport, and transplant, and deer management permits cannot be applied. Unless Texas Parks and Wildlife Department obtains conviction in state court, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department rules concerning permit denial cannot be applied in regard to trap, transport, and transplant, deer management permits, or deer breeder permits. Duplicate prosecutions are redundant. They're time-consuming, costly, and divert time and resources from other duties and obligations of all of our law enforcement officers. Currently, persons convicted of Lacey Act violations are continuing to obtain permits and renewals and engage in permitted activities. You'll recall at the last meeting of the commission on March 31st, I covered two separate Lacey Act cases with a brief summary, which resulted in three Lacey Act convictions. I'd like to summarize a case that resulted in a Lacey Act conviction since our last commission meeting. On October the 28th, Parks and Wildlife Special Operations Unit coordinated efforts with the special agents of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to intercept a load of live white-tailed deer, which were imported into Texas from a deer breeder in Oklahoma. Upon completion of the investigation, a defendant, who is and was a current Texas deer breeder, agreed to plead to a felony Lacey Act charge if the state agreed not to prosecute seven trap, transport, and transplant charges pending against him, which are Class B Parks and Wildlife Code misdemeanors. The state agreed not to prosecute the pending state charges, and the defendant pled guilty to felony Lacey Act charges on April the 14th of this year, associated with the illegal importation of live white-tailed deer. The subject is awaiting sentencing and is still currently engaged in permitting activity. I might mention, at this present time, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department does have the authority to deny permits when there is a conviction for trap, transport, and transplant violations.
Yeah, but you've dropped that in this case.
Yes, the local prosecutor agreed not to prosecute.
Well, that makes sense, and then that's where you get him on the heavier felony. Those are misdemeanors. But we don't have any because we've dropped those state charges, then we can't deny him any permit.
That's exactly right, yes, sir.
Okay, he's pled guilty, but he has not been convicted. Is that correct?
No, sir. He's been convicted. He just hasn't faced his penalty yet.
He's on his way to sentencing. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay. So he's pled guilty, so he is now a convicted felon relative to violating the Lacey Act. Yes, sir.
I might also mention, although we cleared one Lacey Act case since the last committee meeting, we now have a minimum of 18 different cases involving Lacey Act violations related to illegal deer importation in Texas, which range in infancy stage up to near completion.
If it gets too far, forgive my question. But one of the things we've been talking about here, or at least dealing with, is if somebody has a Lacey Act conviction someplace else. All of these cases you're talking about is illegal deer transportation, either coming into the state or leaving the state of Texas, right?
Yes, sir.
But the breadth we've been looking at is Lacey Act violation anywhere, any place, theoretically, for anything, in any state, anywhere. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, you are.
I'm asking it's kind of a rhetorical question. Okay.
Yes, sir. I'm going to give an example of something that's kind of come to the surface here in the last day or so in just a moment.
Okay. Now, this is relative to the worries I think we've all heard from people. Okay, go ahead.
Out of the 18 different cases that we have in different levels of progress at the moment, at least nine of those investigations involve at least one person who's currently permitted by the department.
Okay.
Might mention yesterday there was two indictments handed down on two residents of Texas involved in activity in Kansas. They were indicted in Kansas in federal court for Lacey Act violations, and it involved allegedly involved illegal activity involving their outfitting and providing paid hunters with an opportunity and place to hunt in the state of Kansas. According to the indictment that was handed down, indictments that were handed down, two individuals arranged for hunting opportunities for a number of hunters from Texas as well as some other states, I think maybe Oklahoma and Louisiana. Provide him opportunity to hunt with illegal means and methods, including spotlighting, and exceeding the bag limit, and arrange for them to hunt areas where they did not have proper permits to hunt deer. The indictments also allege that these individuals arranged for the transport of deer heads and other animal parts, deer parts, back to Texas from the state of Kansas.
So they've been indicted under the Lacey Act?
Yes, sir.
In federal court?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, I assume they all sound like they're breaking state laws, too. But, yeah, okay.
Yes, sir. The adoption of this proposal would enable the department to deny permit issuance and renewal to those applicants. They're shown flagrant disregard.
Why don't you get your deal? I think you're on your next slide. Aren't you on your next proposed? Maybe I'm reading wrong.
It would allow the department to deny permit issuance and renewal to those applicants who have shown flagrant disregard for the laws which are in place and protect our most valuable wildlife resources, as well as provide additional deterrent for those who are otherwise attempted to do so. I also mentioned that there was a query ran on Lacey Act cases open in Texas by the Texas, by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and it reflected over the last 5 years that less than 1% of the dispositions of those cases resulted in a conviction of the Lacey Act. The vast majority of these cases involve either issuance of a violation notice, which imposes a forfeiture of collateral, or importation, or involve importation of a protected plant or animal at a port of entry, for instance, resulting in a simple abandonment or forfeiture of the item. And neither of those situations constitutes a conviction.
Proposed amendment would allow denial of permit issuance or renewal following conviction. So I understand conviction. On what you're just talking about at a port of entry or something, and the agreement is that they just abandon their whatever, would that be considered an assessment of a civil penalty or a violation?
Actually, my understanding is that the forfeiture of the product, a lot of times if someone brings something in, if it's a small item it's not involved in interstate commerce or something of a commercial type activity, a lot of times the individuals possessing that item will just forfeit it, abandon it, sign an abandonment form, or if they refuse to or they have trouble making contact with that individual, they'll just file a motion for a forfeiture with the federal court system. There's no conviction associated with those. And I understand that there's a significant amount of those cases that involve that type of scenario.
I guess what I'm asking is that considered, so I guess I'm asking somebody here as a lawyer, would that be considered an assessment of a civil penalty?
No, sir.
No, it would not.
No, sir.
As you've already covered, the proposed amendments would allow denial of permit issuance or renewal following conviction or assessment of a civil penalty for a violation of the Lacey Act. This would also allow the department to deny issuance or renewal of a permit for someone convicted of conspiracy to commit the Lacey Act violation. It's important to note here that under the proposed rules, denial of a permit for Lacey Act conviction would not be automatic. The rules authorize the department to deny issuance or renewal, but they do not require the department to deny. On the second bullet, proposed amendments would allow the department to delay processing DMP and Triple T applications if a person is a defendant in a criminal or civil proceeding for Lacey Act violations. An important note here is that since May 23, 2006, the department has had a discretion to delay processing DMP and Triple T permit applications if a person is a defendant in a criminal prosecution for a violation of Parks and Wildlife Code Chapter 43, Subchapter C, E, L, R, which we see, and a violation of 63.002, which is possession of live game animals. Skip over some of the factors the department will consider in determining whether to issue or renew a permit based on the Lacey Act conviction or a civil penalty would include what would not be limited to the seriousness of the offense, the number of offenses, existence of a pattern of offenses, the length of time between the offense and the permit application, and the applicant's efforts towards rehabilitation. The proposed amendments would allow the denial of permit issuance or renewal following conviction or deferred adjudication for violating Chapter 43, Subchapter CELR, a Class A, B, or B misdemeanor or felony, or Parks and Wildlife Code 63.002. Once again, this applies to a person acting as an agent for a permittee, Currently, a conviction within the previous 5 years may be considered when processing a DMP, Triple T, or Deerbreeder application. As directed at the last commission meeting, this amendment removes that 5-year limitation. This was covered in the previous presentation, but currently a DMP is valid from September 1st of 1 year through August 31st of the following year. The proposed amendment would make the permit, a DMP permit, valid from the date of issuance to the last release date authorized under the permit. This slide covers public comment for the expiration date of the DMP permit. As you can see, it's the last figures are 100% in favor. As of this morning, these numbers have changed slightly as far as the LOCAP proposal. 86 comments have been received in favor, and 465 comments opposed the LOCAP amendments.
Those all come in one time.
Yeah, that might be, just might warrant a little comment on that. Our regulations coordinator noticed some fairly unusual patterns with respect to the submission of the electronic comments on our system. Well over 40% of the written comments in opposition to the proposal could be traced back to two unique internet protocols, meaning two unique computers. And it was curious that out of those two computers, you would have representations of individuals from counties as geographically dispersed as Bear and Medina and McLennan and then up in North Texas, making the exact same comment at the exact same time with the exact same misspellings and grammatical miscues. So I bring that up not to cast aspersions on the electronic comments as a whole, but in this case, there at least appears to be an instance in which someone tried to deliberately influence the comments, at least quantitatively. We are keenly aware that y'all have told us to make all electronic related communication as available to the public as possible, and we want to continue doing that. Obviously, we don't want to tolerate the kind of egregious misuse which may have happened in this case. And again, we can trace this back to the unique computer in which it came from. And so we take this very seriously, and we wanted to make you aware of that. Now, there's a lot of very valid comments that were submitted as part of the electronic comment period. But again, our regulations coordinator, Robert McDonald, is very inadvertent, and this is kind of the first time we've seen a pattern as egregious as this appears to be, and we just wanted to let you know that, and that we're going to be watching this very, very carefully from here on out.
And how many of these came from the same IP address?
A little over 40% of them had written reasons for opposition, and basically there were kind of three written comments that were replicated over and over again with the same verbiage, same misspellings, including of their own county. Just curious. So just wanted to let you know that.
I have a little bit of an update for figures up to this morning. It's about 46% of the 212 that gave a specific reason for opposing. About 46% came from six IP addresses, and roughly 32% or 145 of those comments that gave a reason for opposition came from two IP addresses in Waco and were submitted over 6 hours on one day. This is a summary of some of the public comments that we received. Approximately 104 feel it's unconstitutional or a violation of due process. 39 feel there's no guarantee that the department would fairly administer the rules. 16 stated that this would devastate potentially innocent people. 12 feel the proposal is just too broad. 9 thought the penalty was too severe for a minor infraction. 8 felt it should be limited to deer violations only. 6 punishment split the crime. 3 don't trust the federal government.
the field that we should not be able to deny permanently. Two thought the civil penalty should not be a basis for denial of permit issuance or renewal. Three thought that denial and issuance should only be affected by convictions. And these were some other individuals' reasons for opposition. Let's take a look at those. Concludes our proposal or presentation for today. Glad to try to answer any questions you might have.
Got a brand new presentation. I want to say that I'm sure all the other commissioners have gotten a lot of feedback, just letters from concerned individuals about the Lacey Act. But, you know, as you pointed out, Scott, the way I read the regulation right now that we currently have in place, that under current rule, the department may refuse to issue or renew deer permit, all that everything we talked about. And that may is a big part of it. And again, it's not, and you brought that up, Scott. We're not saying that you cannot do it. We're just saying that we're going to, if you violated these laws, then we may use that as a reason not to to issue you the permits. I think that's pretty reasonable myself. You've got somebody that's convicted of importing deer or you know, things. It gives you the latitude to look at as a department and make that decision. So I think that was a very nice job of pointing that out.
The one other part that was brought up is there, let's say you turn somebody down, we do turn somebody down, DPW does, is there any appeal process as part of this? I'm not smart enough to read any regs or and they're going to help us here, somebody. Plus, Commissioner Bevis was not able to be with us today, but it was a question he had too. Is there a way we could put appeal process in the language somehow? If, let's say, somebody, we did turn somebody down.
There is actually a review process. They're not all, they're in different sections, but they're all pretty much the same for all three of these permits, Triple T, DMP, and Breeder. These permits are considered privileges, so there's no, it's not a formal hearing, but there is an internal review that basically in this instance would go up to Ross, to the Deputy Executive Director, and we've conducted those in the past, and you know, I'll just point out, those have not been rubber stamped either. I mean, those are, have been taken very, very seriously, and it enables us to make sure that we're doing things right. So there is an internal review process that is taken very seriously.
Well, I think you made a good point, too, understanding that, again, this, all of these things that we're talking about are privileges. Okay. That helps me. Yeah, thank you.
If you want to see an example of the current process, look at page 100 of the notebook. In item J, and that's the review process for deer breeder denials. And I think it's important to point out that this isn't a giant change in the current rules, because the current rules allow, give the department the discretion to deny a permit for violation
for all state laws.
We're just expanding the grounds that can be considered as a part of this process. So it's not,
new
ground, in my opinion.
No, I'm asking any questions or talk, but I want to make sure we get this out.
Is great question.
That people do understand that, I mean, a lot of this is already really in place. I mean, in the sense that we have a right, we take TPW to withdraw these people for all kinds of acts and issues that an individual might get involved in or get convicted of or do things that they aren't supposed to be doing relative to Texas Parks and Wildlife continuing to allow them to participate in those privileges. So the Lacey Act is just an addition to it, is the way I look at it.
And if I could make one other point about the Lacey Act, I mean, the Lacey Act was originally enacted really kind of for a purpose very similar to what y'all are looking at, which is to fill a gap. Mm-hmm. Because once upon a time, someone could engage in some sort of illegal wildlife activity, take the species to another state, and avoid conviction. And this was intended to address that.
I have some recommendations for everybody to consider on some of the language. I can go through them now. Okay. So you'll turn to page 95 of the notebook under the TTT statutes, or regulation rather, 65-109. And let me say at the outset, I think this process is somewhat cumbersome because we have three different rules, one for DTT, one for DMP, and one for their breeder. And I talked to Ann and suggested that in the future we try to pull all these and put them in one, have one regulation that would apply to all, to the extent that we don't have to exclude deer breeders for purposes of administrative act, carryover under the statute, the administrative act. So I think that's something for a future day, but we start with the TTT language. And to Dan's point under item B, emphasizes the current language says the department may refuse, and we're only striking out the 5-year restriction. But the very next subdivision has the word finally convicted. That's not in the other sections under convictions. I would remove finally. We just say convicted of. And then I'm not positive about this, but I'm not sure that a conviction includes a plea of nolo contendere, and I would add a nolo plea to each of these subdivisions where we have a conviction, because a nolo plea is the equivalent of a guilty plea. So I would add that in each of B1, B2, C, 2, for example, and make it consistent throughout. And in C2, the person should be inserted. It's left out. The person has been convicted. On B, on the top of the next page, after applicant, I would insert or person acting as agent for any applicant, which is consistent with this all applying to an agent, which is not just an applicant.
Where is that?
At the top of 96 under the top item, after applicant, I would add, or person acting as agent for any applicant. So if the agent is a defendant in a criminal prosecution or proceeding, then the department has the discretion to withhold processing. Then you go to the next rule, which is DMP rule, over on page 97 of our notebook under D1. Again, I'd add nolo pleas, and same under 2. Under E2, and then we also need to add after adjudication pre-trial diversion, which was just inadvertently omitted. You see that in the black, the highlighted language immediately above it. That's the federal, and isn't that the federal term for?
That's our understanding, yes.
For it's a term of art in the federal prosecution. Then under F, on page 97, after applicant, I would insert or a person acting as agent for any applicant. Then over on the top of 98, I think we should add the language that is at the top of 96, which gives the department the discretion to withhold processing of an application where the applicant or agent is a party to a criminal proceeding, that needs to be added here, not in the DMP rule. And then the last rule, which is the deer breeder rule, over on page 99, under G1, the word finally should come out. And the NOLO language should go in there as well as in item 2, so it will parallel the other two, the provisions in the other two rules. Top of page 100, again, you would need the NOLO language in H2. And then to the chairman's point, you've got this review process spelled out here in item J, but Ann confirmed a similar substantively identical review process for the DMP and TTT applications are in other rules. And ultimately, I think we should have all three rules and have one review process.
Unless you're doing these reviews over the next 4 years or whatever.
That would actually be, I think, helpful for us. And that's definitely something we can do as part of a separate rulemaking, is just consolidate those. Did you also want to change delay to withhold process?
I would suggest, even though this is a picking unit change, at the top of 96 we have the word delay. I think it could connote indefinitely. I like withhold better.
Mm-hmm. And we can make all those changes, and we'll have a slide tomorrow that reflects it.
They're all
within the logical outgrowth of the rule as proposed.
Yes.
Yeah, I spent all night thinking about that one.
I'm not off bill for that.
We couldn't afford your bill.
Might also let y'all know that there is a information resource here representing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service today. Resident agent in charge, David Hubbard out of San Antonio. If you have some additional Lacey Act related questions, he would be available to answer those.
I think that Ted reminds me about a comment I wanted to make, and that is at the March meeting, Brad, I think you were discussing anecdotally some of these existing proceedings, and you mentioned the father-son breeders who were either convicted or pled guilty to illegally importing whitetail deer from Arkansas. Even though it was considered a misdemeanor, they spent a year in jail and paid a $60,000 fine. Some of the criticisms that I got were, well, this could allow the department to use a minor violation. So I don't think you can to deny a permit. A misdemeanor violation can be a very serious violation.
Sure.
Evidenced by that example that you gave. And I think that's where, to Dan's point, we have confidence in the department's exercise of discretion and in the review process that we're not going to see an unreasonable denial occur.
No, sir.
At least I do.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I just wanted to thank you all for your work in the recent situation that you all dropped convictions here. I just wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you all very much, and appreciate y'all's support for the entire agency and all of the employees.
Thank you.
Yeah,
we appreciate your efforts. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you all the time.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions or discussion. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Chairman,
yeah, thank you, Chairman Creekin.